All right, we are back. Welcome back to Evil Thespian. I am here with Daniel Damiano. Is that, well, last name, is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, good. Perfect. Yeah. Daniel is an award-winning playwright, screenwriter, and award-nominated actor. He is a playwright that has had plays produced throughout the U.S., as well as in Australia and England. We are here to talk about his solo show, One with the Current, directed by Leslie Kincaid Burby. One with the Current will be opening off Broadway September 13th. Daniel, welcome to the show. Super excited to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Maddie. This is great.
Yes. So you are located right now in Brooklyn?
Yes, I am in Brooklyn, New York.
Sweet. How long have you been there?
My wife and I moved here in 2016 after living in Queens for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I'm actually originally from New Jersey. Cool. My wife is from Texas here. And I was living in Queens up until 2016. And then we now live in Sunset Park.
Nice.
Just a hop, skip, and a jump right outside Manhattan.
Yeah. So would you say your background is primarily in playwriting or acting?
Well, both. I mean, mm-hmm. I've basically been wearing those two hats for the bulk of my career. I mean, and primarily in theater, though I've been, you know, kind of branching out. But yeah, for years, I was basically just calling myself an actor playwright. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also write poetry, and now I'm writing novels as well. So I'm kind of been branching out in more recent years. But theater has always kind of been the first love.
Yeah.
And so that's been, you know, the place where I've kind of honed my craft as a writer and actor for sure.
What originally got you into theater?
Wow. I mean, I had the bug probably back when I was in junior high. I just, you know, I started doing plays in junior high and kind of started, you know, reading plays with some seriousness. I mean, as far as a playwright, I remember very, very early on going to my middle school library and pulling out like the collected works of Neil Simon. Mm-hmm. And I mention this too when I teach playwriting, because, you know, that was a real education for me in terms of reading dialogue, both mm-hmm. from a playwright's perspective and from an actor's perspective, because Neil Simon, you know, even though he might not be as popular at the moment as he was when he was in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, where he was everywhere, it's reading his stuff is really very instructional for actors and writers, because it's so clear in the rhythms. You can just see that. It's like reading music. And so that was kind of an early indication of how, when I was starting to take it seriously, both as an actor and as a writer. And then I kind of always, my mother was working in New York. We were living in Jersey at the time, and I remember her, and she took The Death of a Salesman when I was like 14 years old with mm-hmm. Dustin Hoffman on Broadway. Yeah. which was really life-changing. I mean, I already was taking it seriously as mm-hmm. something I knew I wanted to do after high school, but that to this day is kind of a pinnacle for me, from a playwriting perspective and from an acting perspective. It kind of was just all there for me. And I always look to that as both being a very inspiring moment for me, and also the kind of goals I set for myself.
Mm-hmm. And you went to university theater?
No. I went to, very, very much to the contrary. I actually I came to New York as a student of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Gotcha.
But I dropped out. But I did learn, the short time I was there was very much education for me, but I don't have any long formal education mm-hmm. in theater.
Yeah, well, I mean, being in New York for so long, I guess you could consider that a formal education.
Exactly. It's the Robert Frost poem. It's, you know, the road mm-hmm. less traveled. It's kind of whatever gets you to where you need to be. And mm-hmm. for me, it was just experiencing theater and just doing it. working in different situations and getting my chops that way. So that was huge. However, I will say, when I was at the academy, what I really came away with in the short time I was there, which was really important for me, was in the voice and the movement class, because I was never really conscious of those things coming out of high school. I was very much I still very much consider myself a character actor. To me, I've always been very interested in doing, in character-based work, and I like doing different accents when I can and all that kind of stuff. But I had some very interesting teachers the short time I was at the academy, specifically in voice. They made me very conscious of diction and very conscious of posture. So I attribute those to be the major things that I came out of my very short time at the American Academy with. So I was at least thankful for that, and I needed that.
I mean, I feel the same. You kind of learn that your body or your voice can change just from like a simple adjustment of your posture.
Sure.
It's really, really interesting. I remember when I was in school, I had, 3 hour long class of just simply warming up, and I'd feel like a completely different person by the end of the class when my voice
Oh,
was
I bet.
different.
I bet. Where did you go to school?
I went to Radford University, very small state university, probably class of like about 100 people in our program, but really
Interesting.
comprehensive. I fo My focus was in acting, but in my program, we were required to like build sets, learn how to build a flat, use power
Oh,
tools,
yeah.
and really, we had to learn how to hang a light on the
Yeah.
grid, the whole bit, and
Yeah.
everybody was kind of required to do a little bit of everything,
Yeah.
which is great. And I think theater is such a collaborative, immersive, teamwork-oriented form that it
Absolutely.
really is such a great thing to be a part of because it's very community-centered, and I think no matter what, city you're in, it's really, there's kind of many levels of entry points to get into and like forming a community.
Absolutely. And it's really good to know all the components, because even if you only ultimately focus on one thing, if you're just an actor, it's really important to know all the components of what make it. So if you can work behind the scenes once or get a little familiar with that, or just know a little bit about the producing aspect or the marketing aspect, I mean, those are all things that just make you stronger and more complete and more appreciative of the theater, because as you well know, it just takes so much. There are so many components to, casting, from the creation of the thing, from the writing of the play, casting of it, to the rehearsing of it, and to the marketing of it and getting an audiences to see it. I mean, it's multifold. And just to be, I find that, I know in New York, I know a lot of, I have, quite a few folks like myself self-generate a lot. I mean, I have my own production company with my wife. I have friends that have their own film companies and whatever. And it's an education in itself, because you have to do a lot of different components, and it makes you really appreciate it all the more, to have that much experience exposure.
When you were kind of starting out in New York, did you originally kind of get your feet wet doing more playwriting or acting?
I was kind of always doing both. I probably wasn't auditioning as much as I should have, but the writing always seemed to fill that need. I think I probably would have been a lot more proactive as an actor as far as marketing myself and just auditioning more if I wasn't a writer. But the writing always really filled a large aspect. So I was kind of always just navigating, like seesawing, kind of back and forth. That's kind of what I kind of do to this day, almost, to be honest with you.
When you start writing a play, do you usually start with dialogue or maybe a character?
I mean, ultimately, my plays are character base. I mean, sometimes the impetus of things can vary. It can be, an idea, a setting, or a type of character, or like a regional setting, or themes that I kind of want to get into. But ultimately, it does start with character. That's always, 99% of the time, that's the driving force of things, is the character. You can write a lot about themes, and I this is things I've discussed with, like, when I do workshops and stuff, is like, it's important to write about issues that are important to you, but if it's not rooted in a character that an audience can go with, then they might as well see a documentary or a news article. What differentiates what we do, was a playwright, do, is creating a character that the audience can live through, and therefore the issues that you want to discuss become that much more important because we're seeing it through the eyes of the audience. So I always try and remember that, and just always come at it, character first, by and large.
Well, let's talk about your solo show and kind of the character. It's based around One with the Current. So how did this kind of whole, like the process of this show begin? Like, what was the impetus for writing the show?
Well, I wrote this in the spring of 21. So about April, May, I think I wrote the entirety of it. And initially, so the very loose synopsis, just to include your audience in this, is it's about this North Carolina man. His name is Cliff, who's much, my age. He's early 50s. He has two kids and a wife, and they live in a, small, very rural area of North Carolina. He's a very working class, good guy, good husband and father, and his pride and joy is his hardware store that he owns. And he what's the central events of the play, which kind of goes back and forth in time between, like, January 20, 2021, late 2020, and then, like, the more distant past. Goes back and forth in that time span. He takes a fishing trip with an old childhood friend, and it's basically the events surrounding that fishing trip that are essentially what play is about and how it affects him. And so, yeah, I wrote it in the spring, and it's, it's about a 70-minute piece, and we did a, initial meeting for a small group of people at points, and then got to premiere it last September at in New York City at the Dream Up Festival, which is a festival that's run out of a place called Theater for the New City, which is in the East Village. And so it got, like, like six performances, and it got, like, a review, which is kind of important because it's what we're primarily using to market the show now. But we got its feet wet that way, and it was quite successful. And then I got to do it as a one-off at a place called the New York Society for Ethical Culture, which is like a landmark institution here in Manhattan. And I have a kind of a previous relationship with them, having done readings there. And I did a one-off performance for about over 100 people there, which was quite exciting. And as a result, even met somebody that was there that became, like, a primary funder for what is now this production that we're going to be doing for 4 weeks in September, October.
Excellent. How would you describe, I mean, have you done I mean, prior to the show, have you done a solo show before?
Yeah, this is my third one.
Wow.
I but first one I and I didn't set out to, like, be a solo performance artist. Again, it's sometimes these things you fall into out of necessity. You want to create something for yourself, because I never write plays for myself. I always write them for other actors. I want to give work to other actors. But yeah, so I had two previous solo shows that were more in the style of I don't know if you're familiar with Eric Bogosian, who's
That sounds familiar.
yeah, he's a terrific solo performer. He's known for shows like Drinking in America and Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll. And he ba his solo
Oh,
shows
yeah.
generally didn't have one central story. They were just individual character monologues. And so my first two solo pieces were kind of modeled on that. I had they were like four different character monologues, but they were thematically connected. And my last one was called American Tranquility. Did quite well. I did it several places in the city. I also did it at the Capitol Fringe in DC. And it was basically about four different aspects of American society, from ageism to immigration to societal disconnection in our cyber age, to political extremism. I did like a right-wing shock jock guy kind of has a meltdown. And it was like really fun to do because it was like four halves of four, and everyone saw themselves in like different parts of it. This one with the current, is my first solo piece that is one character in one single story. So that was really exciting for me, write a solo play more in the style of how I write my plays, which is one story. So yeah, it's just one guy and it's one single story. So that's the main difference.
When how would you describe like the character in this show, like essentially his personality? He's from North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there's some pretty big reveals in the show, and some of which are probably going to slip out in this interview, which is completely fine, because people, when they see it, they're going to know, or when it gets reviewed, it's going to be out there. But I mean, the essence of the show initially is, you really get to know this guy as himself, not for what he ultimately participates in within the play. That is a, I will say, a very regrettable act, but you get to know him well before that act, and well before you kind of know you're supposed to know kind of what's coming. So you just know him as an affable guy who works hard, who loves his family, and that's it. He really is kind of a salt of the earth guy. What happens, basically, what's the hook of the play is that through the results of what's happening in the world at the time the play is set, and with the pandemic, and how it affects his business, and the desperation that comes from someone who, has two kids, has one kid in college, and another, who he ultimately one day would like to leave his door to. He has a daughter, an eldest daughter who's actually in her first year of college. And then he has a son who's still in high school, who's quite close to him, and who wants to work with his father in his store someday. And obviously Cliff would love to leave the store to his son if the son wants that. So those are kind of the aspirations of his life. And what the play, the conflicts, one of the conflicts of the play is that you see that this man's simple aspirations are threatened, and what that does to him, and what that does to his mindset. And that's kind of the crux of play, is how good people can do regrettable things.
Do you think in, I mean, definitely a lot to unpack because I often feel like, coming from background as an actor and like character study, I'm always interested in kind of everybody's motivations for engaging in this kind of like protection-oriented fight or flight response and like our actions and how people perceive that. Do you ever feel like, I mean, in our social ecosystem that's so very digital and operated by like multiple stimuli at one time, do you feel like we're as a society becoming less, maybe, I mean, it's kind of corny to say, people say it all the time, but like less connected to
Oh,
our
absolutely.
common humanity.
Yeah, without question. I mean, I think what's really getting lost now is that because we have generations that are used to more communicating digitally and not personally interacting with people, that we're getting more of that, like that's the way to communicate. And then we have also, in our cyber era, we have, outlets by which people, say things and put things out there that they probably wouldn't dare to another person in person. So we're getting a lot, it's getting kind of brazen and audacious, and that's why it's the adverse result of our cyber culture. I mean, obviously there's pluses to it. We can connect with people that are, on the other side of the country, other side of the world, and we can do Zoom chats, and we can connect with people that we are not next door to. But there are obvious adverse aspects to it, and connecting in this time, like really connecting, is challenging. It really is. I mean, I actually went. I went through a period a few years ago where there were some people that were just kind of out of my life, but they were people that I liked, just kind of fell out. Not in a bad way. It's just how things happen. You just lose connect. And I reached out to them and I said, you know what? Let's go to a diner. Let's have lunch. And that I did that with like a couple of people, and like we're really like very good friends now. And I feel like, it takes some effort to be proactive like that. And I'm not saying I'm always like that. I'm not. We get very apathetic. We get, we have other things that we're focused on in our life, but it is important to kind of know what's important. And the older you get, you see that, the brevity of life, and the importance to be really connected to things. And I think I've said this even recently, and I know you, I'm sure you know this play well, Our Town. There's that scene in Our Town that I saw, the David Cromer. Are you in Chicago, by the way? Are you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you know David Cromer quite well, I'm assuming. So I saw his production of Our Town that came here. And it was quite lovely. It was very bare bones, but there was that one scene where I think it's Emily who says she can revisit a memory, and they basically open this curtain, and it's her mother making breakfast, and you smell the bacon, and you smell all this, and it's the only real thing in the play because everything else is mimed in this production. And she's like brought to tears because it's like she couldn't appreciate that in the moment when her mother was here, but now that it's a memory, all of a sudden she appreciate it more. And I think that's kind of how life happens, and it's important all the more, I think, try and be conscious about living in the moment. And that's another challenge of our time, is it's hard because things are going by so fast, and it's all about it's all about progression. It's all about we friends of mine and I were talking about this recently. I was like, we had the vinyl record for over 100 years and no one really complained about it. And now you have to have a new iPhone every year. Something the pedal is so stepped on with accelerating advancement. It's really like triple time in the last 20, 30 years to the point where now we're seeing the human artist jeopardy, with AI and all this stuff. We can go down a whole separate rabbit hole with that, but I mean that's unsettling in itself. And again, it's all coming back to the human connection, the human element, and just always knowing the value of that, and not never losing sight of that.
Yeah, and kind of like I feel like as a society we're very disconnected, or we don't have, there's like a sixth sense of understanding the other person's affect, kind of how like they're physically in a room and connecting with that. And I feel like theater is the conduit for tapping into that like sixth sense that is,
Absolutely.
that we don't really, it's a muscle we don't really get to exercise a lot. What is the name of the character in this play?
It's Cliff. We
Cliff.
never
Oh,
know his
yes.
la we never know his last name, but
Cool.
it's Cliff. Yeah.
Cool. What is his connection to the internet like?
It's that actually is not really mentioned in the play.
Okay.
Basically, what what he gets roped into is just kind of what is in the air at that moment. And also his friend who he speaks to in several scenes of the play, but we never physically see him. I don't like even do the other guy's voice, but we'll like speak to him in scenes that he's with him. And he gets a lot of information from him, from this childhood friend who's kind of influencing him in certain ways and leaning him ultimately to the perspective he grows to develop through the course of the play. So you his knowledge of kind of what's happening in the world and politically is you we're only getting it from that. We're not there's not anything of I mean I'm sure he's online and getting stuff, but it's not noted in the play at
But
rooms he's in or something.
yeah, but he's kind of driven by kind of this aim to protect his business. I mean, I
Yes.
remember I was kind of thinking about the year 2020 and like how strange that was because it is, I look back on like 2020 and even 2021, and it almost feels like a blur. Like, I don't feel so overwhelmed with media frenzy anymore, but I felt like I was talking to my husband about this. It was such a weird time because I felt like my face was constantly immersed in some kind of just in very intense political
Oh,
propaganda. It was very
yeah.
overwhelming. It felt like you're intellectually drowning all the time because,
Well, there was no
yeah.
escape. I mean, we were
Yeah.
all in our homes for a long time, or we weren't venturing very far from home, unless people were like people in the city. Some people were retreating to places in the country if they had them. But by and large, I mean, yeah, we were kind of trapped for a while. And so there was no choice, unfortunately, but to be exposed with a lot of that stuff. And it was, yeah, you really had to self-preserve as much as you could because it was a tough period to live through for many reasons, you know.
Yeah, it
But
was so strange. What was going on in your life at that time? I was sitting down a lot working from home, very
oh, me
sedentary.
too. I mean, my I always joke, but it was true. My wife was even because I mean, I have to say, I mean, creatively, it was. I really gave myself a lot of tasks, and I had quite a bit of output during that time. I mean, I finished my first novel, which I had basically been kind of put it on back burner. And then when the pandemic hit, I was just like, well, now's as good a time to commit myself to this because I was writing other things. I just was like, no one's in a rush for me to write a novel, so there's no rush for me to do it. So I was writing all the other my other stuff. And then the pandemic came, and I was like, I'm just going to finish this damn thing. So I finished that. I wrote a book of poetry that's also published called 104 Days of the Pandemic. And
What?
basically, I wrote a poem a day from March 19th, 2020, which was the week after all the crap hit, until my birthday, June 30th, 2020. I didn't know, of course, when the foreseeable end was going to be, and I didn't see myself writing a poem a day in perpetuity. So I figured that would end it. You know, I'll just end it then, and then it became 104 days of the pandemic. Yeah, and I just had other writing projects. I recorded some music from home, and I just really tried to stimulate myself as much as I could creatively. So I feel like at least that wasn't. I didn't have a like wasted time, you know. And then I even had a as a survival job. I ended up working for the census, which was quite interesting
Wow,
to
what a
do the.
time.
Yeah, well, they had postponed it. It was supposed to happen in the spring of 2020 because you know it's every 10 years, and then it was obviously delayed, and then it didn't start until August. So I did it like August, September, and that was quite interesting to
Wow.
do.
What did you have to do for that?
Well, literally, I was a door-to-door census taker.
Wow, that's exactly what I imagine in my mind when I think of that.
It's old school. I mean,
Wow.
you basically work within the vicinity of your neighborhood, so that's was kind of cool. They give you like your own little, Android kind of phone with, addresses and stuff. I mean, I didn't like see a lot of people because a lot of people weren't answering their doors. But all the questionnaires were there, and
Oh,
of course,
wow.
I was wearing a mask and taking all the precautions. But yeah, it was interesting. It was definitely chalked it up to some life, some material,
Yes,
for sure.
definitely. I mean,
But
it's a
yeah, just.
good social aspect of that as
Oh,
well.
absolutely. And
Yeah.
it really was interesting, and it was surreal, of course, at that time, to knock on people's doors and not knowing where people were at and stuff like that, and especially doing the census. I mean, I was doing the census in a time where, and I live in a neighborhood that's very I mean, New York, as you may know, you can one neighborhood to the next has its own different blends of culture.
Oh, yeah.
And the neighborhood we're in now is called Sunset Park in Brooklyn, and it's heavy Chinese and Mexican in particular. And there's blends of others, but that's the kind of the primary. And this was also at a time where people that were immigrants, in 2020 didn't feel particularly protected. And so you're dealing with some people that I think were acted like I was, ISIS coming to the door or something, when it's the complete opposite. You're there to protect them, and actually the more information you get, valuable, because then it tells the local governments what they can, who they need to spend money on. And under count, then you the area, the districts get less money. So the more people you speak to, it's actually better. But all that just made it very, very, very interesting. And it was just one other aspect aside from the creative stuff I was doing that made that, year and a half, 2 year period, interesting, too.
I mean, it was a hard time in terms of like thinking about what does one do creatively. I often find myself like scheduling time, like even if I don't want to be creative, I think there's always times where I have to kind of just, glue my eyes to a page or like start just doing something. And
Oh,
I was
sure.
wondering, like, do you ever feel like most of the, when you're writing, do you ever like schedule times where you just need to force yourself to write or do something because the system's not always on like 24/7, but sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm in writer's block or I'm just having a dry period. How like do you get through those times of feeling like something needs to come out?
I never, I'm kind of one of those people, Maddie, that kind of think writer's block is just kind of a myth. It's like you shouldn't necessarily, you're not obligated, nor should any teacher ever tell you that you should be pumping out a certain amount of pages every day. You just can't. And if you're not feeling it, you just do something else to distract yourself. And so I've never really, knock wood, been in that situation where I just feel like, boy, there's just nothing here. I just got nothing. I mean, basically, if I'm not feeling like writing, I'll read or do something else. But usually, and I always make time to write. I mean, I've had times in my life where I've had survival jobs that were taking like way too much of my time, and yet I still would write late evenings if I had to, or write whenever, write on the train. I mean, the joy of public transportation and living in New York and Chicago, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Is you don't have to worry about driving. You
Yeah.
sit on the train, you can write, you can read, you can so I never have felt that. I mean, now I feel in my life I do have more time to do all that than I've ever had. But yeah, I just think if it's something that you love to do, you always find time for it. And
Yeah.
that's always kind of been my mantra, and I always tell that to people. It's never feel something is dominating your life to the extent where you just can't do something else. I mean, because writing is something you really is one of those wonderful things, like painting or making music. You can do it. You can do it at home. You don't have to go through all these, just grand things to make it happen. It's your own intellect that trigger it. So just
And
tap
it's
into it.
free, kind
And
of.
it's absolutely free, and it's just in itself empowering. And you're not there's no one at a table across from you with their arms crossed judging you. It's just you. And so just allow yourself that there's so many minutes in a day and hours, and there's some time there. So if you're feeling fertile. If you're feeling, those creative juices, then they have to be channeled, and that's you owe it to yourself to make sure you do that.
I was gonna ask, who's your favorite poet?
Anne Sexton.
Oh.
Yeah, she's. Do you know her? She.
I don't, possibly.
You know Sylvia Plath?
Yeah.
She's like in the same in the same kind of. They're both labeled as like confessional poets. Sylvia Plath came a little before Paxton, but Sexton, but they did cross over. They actually knew each other. But you should. Yeah, I highly recommend reading Anne Sexton. She's actually. I list her like just with playwrights and other writers that influence that inspire me, because her writing is so honest and so and unfortunately there are a lot of parallels with her and Sylvia Plath. They both killed themselves. They both died young. They both, were kind of manic depressants. Were wonderful poets, and sometimes unfortunately that's sacrifices. These artists is they really put all it all out there, and that's really all that they are, and then they're kind of dying inside. But Sexton is wonderful in terms of especially she was a obviously a woman writing in the 60s and 70s, and very honest stuff about everything from affairs she had to menstruation to just to her own depression and struggles, and just a very, very inspiring and grounded writer. And so, as a poet, she's right up there for me.
Do you feel like your poetry influences make their appearance in your playwriting?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I actually have I've written like a play that's like all in rhymed couplets, so that kind of but I. Yeah, I think so. I think because there's rhythm in both of those styles of writing, and I think there is some sort of a synthesis there. So whether I'm consciously aware of it or not, I think it kind of one does help the other. I think I've been good playwright for longer than I've been a good poet. Poetry is it's funny. You think, oh, you just write a 10 lines. You can kill yourself over just 10 lines. And then to me, it was always like, trying not to overwrite. Like sometimes you just didn't need those last two lines in a stanza. You could just end it, be a little more ambiguous and get out of the room. Don't try and explain it too much. And that's the thing, the challenge with poetry, because I work better on larger canvases anyway. Like I love writing full-length plays. I like writing longer things. That was the greatest challenge for me, was learning brevity. So I feel like I feel very confident now of myself as a poet, but it hasn't been as long as I felt about myself as a playwright. So.
I really like kind of like what you said about being extremely honest and exposed as an artist and really tapping into like the deepest parts of yourself. What do you feel like in the show one with the current, what are like Cliff's main points of like vulnerability?
Well, it's again the kind of the theme is that if we see, like, going back to what you said about our cyber culture, we read all these articles about these actions that people do, and we sometimes we're judging a person based on this action that they do that may be pretty reprehensible, and we paint a brush that that's who they are because we have no reason to know anything more about them. And I guess what the play is supposed is tries to get across is that, a good person, a person that you could actually anyone in the audience could want to sit with and be with, is capable of an error in judgment, and it's designed to basically make him, despite him being from North Carolina and us doing this play in New York, it is designed that you just really appreciate this guy as a guy first before you kind of get to know and what prompt actions that are regrettable him. And it's just that it could happen to anybody, ultimately. It's that, there but for the grace of God. It's like, none of us are flawless human beings. None of us have done nothing that's regrettable in our lives. It's just the degrees of which that vary. And this kind of brings that home in a particular way, and with the backdrop of the timeliness of the times we live in, particularly last couple of years.
Yeah, and I was even thinking about how culturally we're very kind of bred under this like in this landscape of perfectionism. There's always like this pressure to be squeaky clean and sort of become part of this fabric of perfectionism. And even being an artist, it feels at some point in your life like there's an insecurity. Well, I feel like not like that anymore, but when you're starting as an artist, you feel like, oh God, I'm not one with society, or it's an isolating feeling, and you feel like something must have gone awry, or I still need to be like this like content making machine or something like that. And I absolutely cannot make a mistake, but I think the more you kind of interact with people in person, and you're connected to like the physical world as much as possible, you're more like so much more forgiving. Like once we started to come out of COVID and like socialize again, you did get this feeling of everybody's shoulders like coming back down. Like everybody's shoulders were like up to their ears. And I think that's like extremely important. Like socialization is the opposite of isolation, and yeah, isolation really drives us. It's like the worst thing that you could do to a person, essentially.
Well, yeah, because ultimately, it's kind of interesting. I actually was at this event recently, and I it was basically these it was the it were these students that were they were graduates of like NYU and Yale, and they had these upstart businesses, and they were like pitching these new businesses that they were either off the ground or they were still seeking funding on. And I remember there was this one young lady who had this idea for a role-playing game for shy people. And I realized that was kind of a real contradiction in terms, because you can be the greatest person at the role-playing game, at a cyber online role-playing game. You can be the best at that, but it's not going to compare to dealing with a human being and being any less shy and talking to a human being. There's like no substitution for that human connection. And I thought it was kind of like that's a tough sell. To get a shy person who doesn't like to, maybe doesn't want to, feels funny about talking to the opposite sex, and then they're going to do it in this online role-playing game, and that is basically going to make him be able to relate to a human being the same way. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that
And we
doesn't
shouldn't think that.
Yeah, and it doesn't make like 'cause online life already is a kind of a role-playing game, and it's almost like the like mindset that everything is a game. It just like makes me very overwhelmed. I'm like, how do I win at like as a competitive person? I'm like, I need to win the game, but that's not really the point. Like if you're constantly like focused on like winning the game, or like you said, thinking about like the next thing, the next iPhone or whatever, you're not like enjoying. Like I always think, I'm kind of like cynical about like the whole mindfulness stuff, but it's I always come back to it because I'm like, damn, like people really need that stuff, like really need to be in the present and like slow down.
It's true, I mean, it really is true. And I think, when you read things like, I don't know if you ever read Walden by Walt Whitman. It's
Oh no.
not Walt Whitman, Thoreau, I'm sorry.
Oh yeah.
It's a classic book. It's about a guy who basically he lived in the woods for a year. And actually one of the pieces that I had in my prior solo play, American Tranquility, was kind of inspired by that. It's this guy from Brooklyn who's so sick of the disconnect that he feels with people in society that he just moves into the woods. And he has this whole conversation with, you think it's to the audience, but by the end, you realize he's talking to a wolf. And he's just having this whole monologue to a wolf, because he feels it's just he's more connected than he could be in society. And I think that's kind of what we kind of have to go back to, not to the extreme, not that we have to throw or be, give away our apartments and go into the woods, but it really is important to, even when you go to a park and touch a tree, that's real. And
Yes, absolutely.
we can't lose sight of it. You can't lose sight of that the sky is there. While everyone's looking, crane necked at their phones, and you got to remember this, what's giving you light, and all that stuff. So it's we it, and that's the challenge. That's the challenge for all generations. It's not just for younger people that are coming into life this way. It's for older people that just kind of fall into it because that's how everything works, and you have to also condition yourself to remember a life, what real life is, and nature around you and all that.
Yeah, I like this tension between thinking about a solo show and how like there's one person doing like a series of monologues and storytelling. There's only one person on the stage, but there's like all of these people in an audience. Do you think doing a solo show, you feel the audience connection more like potently?
Oh, you have to. I've actually taught solo performance. I taught once at the acting studio here in New York, and also our own company has an educational wing. Whenever we get like space, we have like workshops, and that's a question that I've gotten from students, which is, well, who do you play off of? I'm like, well, the audience is your energy. You have to, but also you have to create much more of the energy. Whereas if there were other actors on stage, you feed each other. But the challenge with doing a solo show is you are your own energy, and you also take it off the audience. Now you can't solely rely on the audience because, as you know, you have audiences that sometimes you're feeling them a little more, and other times they, those Sunday matinee crowds that are a little more docile. And you can't work off that. So you have to create the energy. And so it is a little, there's more required of you in a solo show, without a doubt. You're there by yourself, you're filling a stage, and that's kind of on you, to do it. But you just it, it's nice when you feel it from an audience. It certainly does help you. I mean, this piece is interesting because my pieces in the past had a lot of humor in it, as well as like pathos. This piece, while there is funny stuff in it, is by and large more of a dramatic piece. So it's not like I'm hearing the laughs a lot. But you hear the interest often. You hear just sometimes silence is even better, that listening silence, that sense of an audience being locked in, and that really is an energy too. If you feel that, it really can help.
Yeah. I was wondering, do you have any kind of personal connection to the character? Do you feel like there are any similarities between yourself and the character at all?
It's interesting because I mean, we're both married. And that it
Mm-hmm.
kind of ends there. I mean, I'm
Yeah.
from Jersey, he's from North Carolina, but I always find myself in these characters, and not necessarily when I'm playing, I'm just characters in my plays. And I think that's really important for me as a writer, and also as in the results of the writing, is that you have to find yourself in these people. Otherwise, you're kind of judging them, and that will show. If
Yeah.
you're at arm's length and you're like, well, this isn't me, but I'm writing about this type of person.
Right.
So it's funny. I feel like there's aspects of him in me, but it's not like we're really similar. We're similar people. I mean, I was from a working class town in New Jersey. It was not dissimilar kind of people, except in a different region. But you know, and I guess what I appreciate, I guess the big thing I connect with him in the play is that, you know, I've had to create a lot of my own work, and the hardware store that he has bought is kind of the equivalent of that. You know, this is his, you know, him. And he, there's a scene in the play, and again, this is like a flashback, it goes back and forth time, and this is actually a flashback scene later in the play, where he visits the grave of his father. And his father was kind of a ne'er-do-well. His father was an alcoholic, and he kind of abused his mother, and you don't really get a sense of the relationship until this scene in when he visits his father's grave for the first time. And the reason why he visits his father's grave, where his father's been dead for like 6 years at that point, and the reason why he visits his father's grave at that point, tell him that he's bought his own business, and he wants to share this news just because. And he says in his speech to his father's grave that he's the only one of his friends that has his own business. So they all work for someone else. They all hate every goddamn minute of it. And it's something that his father, a bit of advice his father gave him, even though his father never was able to follow the advice. He credits the father for giving him the advice to not just go along with what everyone else is doing. And he said, you know, if you hadn't done that, I probably wouldn't have the drive to do this. So he gives his father that much credit, even though he has a lot of resentment towards his father as well. And so, yeah, that kind of thing I connect with, and the fact that what that store means to this guy is that he's not like everybody else. He hasn't gone with the flow in that respect. You know, one with the current is kind of a metaphor for that, but also something else more critical story. But it's a metaphor for going with the flow. You know, like fish go with their pod, or they go with their swarm. You know, humans don't have to do that. Humans have individualization, individual minds. And if you take that moment to say, this is what I don't want to do this. I don't want to work in a chicken processing plant like my friends. I want to have my own business. And setting yourself aside, having that dream, you know, that is, I guess, what people would, what is an aspect of an American dream, is you have something that's your own. You're not under someone else. You're not at the mercy of someone else. You know, have your own thing. And then what's in question is, well, what happens when that is in jeopardy? You know, when all that you've worked for is in jeopardy of being taken from you by circumstances that are out of your control. And the central theme.
I really like what you said about someone's business being someone's dream. I think back to when I was a waitress and I worked for so many jack-offs that were so mean to me, and they were horrible managers, horrible people, but they were so, but I when I look back on those characters and their personalities and like the kind of people they were so passionate, and that's something I really did connect with the people I worked for, even though
Good for you.
they were mean to me and disrespectful kind of personalities, and it was just part of the fabric of their character, but they were extremely passionate, and it literally was their whole dream. And I always think about that because I'm definitely somebody who gets like very hot and bothered about something I'm passionate about, and then it comes, and I always get embarrassed because like it comes off some kind of way. But I think it's just an aspect of like, because it's about language too, and how language, if we didn't have language, we couldn't make connections. But there's multiple parts to a person, like language and like their affect and their actions. And then when you only like see maybe one kind of stream or string of those people, you kind of get lost in actually the holistic view of somebody. So it always, right. I always think of those things, like in the moment, I'm like, oh my God, that guy was so mean to me, or I worked with this one person and they're such an asshole. But then when I look back on it, I'm like, oh, what a great time. That guy was just great.
Yeah. Well, that's good that you can have that perspective. And mm-hmm. yeah, sometimes, you know, in the moment, it's hard for us to see it. You know, if someone is abrasive to us or disrespectful, obviously it's hard to see beyond mm-hmm. that, but maybe retrospectively, sometimes you can see that, you know, if it wasn't necessarily abusive, it was just out mm-hmm. of a certain passion or survival instinct.
Yeah.
You can at least have more of a sympathy, for what they were, where they were coming.
Oh, absolutely. I also was wondering, hardware stores. So when I grew up, we had like our hardware stores, we would call them general stores. Did you mm-hmm. grow up with like general stores, or do you call them hardware stores? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. We actually had a general store where I was growing up in Jersey, but it wasn't mm-hmm. the same. It was mm-hmm. a general store was kind of more like a convenience store.
Mm.
And a hardware, I've always just known a hardware store as a hardware store.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, we did have like a general store. It was actually mm-hmm. might've been even the name of the place. But it was just like what we call here in New York, a bodega.
Right.
Or,
yeah.
you know, really it's just a place where you get a bunch of different kinds of, you know, get your toilet paper, get your pack of cigarettes, or get, mm-hmm. you know, some other, you know, related things. Mm-hmm. But a hardware store is kind of a separate entity, at least from where mm-hmm. I came from. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that the character in the play has a hardware store, because I feel like, you know, those skills of like making things, and general, craftsmanship that used to be sort of a baseline, like home economic skill, is not like the closest hardware store. I mean, there's a Home Depot down the street for me, but like a local neighborhood hardware store is probably 2 miles away from me. And it doesn't set, like, there's still other things that are there. Like there's, I don't know. It's hard to describe, but it's one of those things where like, I really, when I think about those things, I'm like, oh, I really appreciate my theater background, because I learned how to like use some power tools in case I need to bust out those skills, maybe.
Sure.
You know?
Absolutely.
But it kind of goes along with some of the themes of the play, and things, you know, things being lost, or some things being, what do you do when things are threatened, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what is further noted in the play, just coming back to it for a second, is, you know, he also mentions that at a couple of different intervals in the play that, you know, the lot that he bought to build the hardware store on was nothing but like a vacant lot where like attics hung out. I mean, it was basically, you know, a boon to mm-hmm. the area that he's in. So there's even that pride in that. It's not just business, but it's also, you know, it was a boon to the local town to have it, mm-hmm. To have it there, and to have all that kind of sense of importance, and then have it negated is, you know, a further gun punch. And it's also what a lot of, you know, we feel it in New York very strongly with mom and pop businesses.
Oh,
because
yeah.
I would imagine it's not similar in Chicago.
Oh, it's you feel it for sure.
I mean, you get one, you know, one made. I mean, we don't have Walmarts here or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you know, you have like a larger, you know, a larger chain store, and it, you know, can really rapidly affect, you know, three or four smaller businesses. And the commercial real estate in New York is merciless. I mean, there's like really, there's no real cap on commercial real estate. So mm-hmm. I don't know how it is in Chicago, but you know, in how it is in New York, commercial real estate is if you move into a neighborhood that's, say, maybe not particularly popular, so not particularly gentrified or mm-hmm. affluent, so maybe you can get a good deal for, like, you know, when you sign your original lease, then that 10-year mm-hmm. lease goes up and the neighborhood changes. Now the landlord can basically triple or quadruple your rent.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a place like a bar you know, or places where there's just no way you're going to be able to pay 15, 20, $25,000 a month. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's basically what we're seeing in New York with that. We're seeing, you know, small restaurants and stuff that you know, cultural institutions that, you know, if they're not getting help, there's just no way. There's
Yeah.
just no way they're going to be able to pay a rent like that.
Yeah. Oh,
And
it's
yet,
very
yeah.
similar here, like to I mean, even some of the big chains, there used to be like a small Whole Foods down the street from me, and it was there forever, but just in the last year and a half, it like and it was actually the close my closest grocery store, and in the last year and a half, it completely shut down, and now it's just a vacant, for lease place, and it's too expensive for even like Whole
Oh
Foods
yeah.
to be
And
there.
it's like,
Yeah.
where's the victory? It's like there is no
Right.
victory here. It's like there is no, you know, I've heard like local like Congress people on like public access shows talk about this. It's like, you know, you think these landlords were getting like a great tax write-off deal for them to be vacant, but they're like, they're really not. There really is nothing that justifies it except that they're just holding out, thinking they're gonna get some sugar daddy that's gonna move
Right.
in there and
Yeah.
pay this exorbitant rent. It's just blatant greed. And I will tell you on a more personal one. So my solo show before One with the Current was called American Tranquility, and we did two runs at this small theater in the East Village called the East Village Playhouse. It was really perfect for solo shows. It was like a jewel box. It was like 30 seats, so it was easier to fill. And we had a relationship with them where they actually would let us just perform there rent free, and they would just take the box office, which was great. And then when I had this show, I reached out to them because I wanted to premiere it there, and they said, "Well, our lease expired about a year ago, and we're literally on life support." Like the landlord,
Wow.
but what was different is that the landlord was letting them stay there. But the landlord also said, as soon as I get someone that's going to take this lease, because they hadn't paid rent in like 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
And the landlord said, as soon as I get someone, you're out. So they couldn't really book it anyway, because
Yeah.
no one wanted to have that kind of instability.
Right.
And finally, you know, someone else took it. But it was one of these places where, you know, there's only so many things it could be. It's a really small, intimate space. It can't be like a bank or a pharmacy. It can only be like a little cafe or a little store or something. It's not going to be a cash cow. So, you know, places like that usually end up being vacant for a
Yeah.
long time, you know. Yeah, it was
Crazy.
sad.
Well, since One with the Current, I mean, it's, going to be opening September 13th.
Right.
What are some things that are on your mind as the rehearsal process is kind of
Well,
flying?
it's funny. It's like, as far as the show is concerned, I'm pretty good with all that. It's really audience building, because that's our biggest challenge. You know, selling a solo show, you know, you just can't do it with just your friends. That's for
Right.
sure. Especially some friends that have already seen it, many of whom who I know will come back. But you just it's you know we're doing six shows a week, for 4 weeks, and
Wow.
so as lead producer, that's kind of where my head is at now, is just trying to assure that we kind of start off in the first week getting audiences so that a word of mouth can be created, and that can help dovetail into the ensuing weeks. But as far as the show's concerned, I'm quite excited. I feel the play is just as timely now as it was, you know, a year ago, and I'm just very, very excited, you know, to share it with more audiences. So I feel we're in a good place with all that stuff, and it's just an issue of, you know, getting audience and getting enough coverage for it, because that's a whole nother animal, and it's an animal you can't control. It's a leashless animal, so to speak, to use that metaphor. But that really is huge, especially for, you know, off Broadway theater, just getting those audiences in. So that's really my focus at the moment.
Sometimes I see like people like guys downtown like handing out their mixtapes to like tourists, and I'm like, that's not a bad idea. At least something I haven't
Hey,
tried yet.
I did that. I think probably with my with some of the stuff we produced early on. I think I also went with postcards. Yeah, I mean, you kind of do what you got to do. Sometimes you got to grab them on the night, you know, because people don't like to do a lot of things in advance,
Yeah, that's
unless it's a
true.
Broadway show, unless they're going to go see Hamilton.
Yeah.
And people, no, and that's the thing I have to remember as a producer, Maddie. I have to constantly think, you know, well, I don't want to do my blasts too far out because I know I don't really respond to blasts that are a month away. So
Right.
I want to make sure I'm a little closer and a little in more proximity of when the dates are. And then also, you know, some people won't get a ticket until the day before, or 2 days before. They just won't. And I just have to keep that in my memory from my years of experience as a producer and also just in being a patron and just understanding that. But it's that fine line because as a producer, obviously you just want to get as much advanced sales as you can. It's it but it's just gets harder and harder, especially now. You know, just the whole act, like everything we've been talking about getting off their computer and coming out. I mean, it really is a yeoman task to get people out of their apartment and to a theater. It's not easy. You know, bars, for some reason, that's the one, well, I know for what reason, but that's the one place, you know, people will always make the effort to go to, especially during a work week, you know, they're just trying to decompress. And it'd be wonderful if it was that easy to get people into a theater. So it's a constant like reinvention of the wheel and what you can do to make it, you know, to get them in. But we're on a good path, so we feel pretty good about it.
That's amazing. Well,
Thank
I'm
you.
glad to hear it's going pretty well, and I wish you all of the luck and hopefully,
Thank
fingers crossed, I'm sending you good vibes for a good turnout.
you. I'll take it.
Where can we kind of find tickets? I'll post a link on all my social media accounts. But where's the
Sure.
best place we can find tickets?
Well, you can go to there's a site called Eventbrite. You can go to eventbrite.com and just literally enter in the show, one with the current. That's the word one with the current. And you can get them right through there. And they're pretty cheap tickets. They're $25 tickets. So we're and actually I will reveal this to you. If anyone can come the first week, we have a code called which is first week. And if you use
First
that code,
week.
it's $5 off. And
Wow.
that's for the performances in September 13th through September 7th, our first week.
Nice. That
And
is a bargain. I have to say, I've seen so many like shows, like even off like off Broadway, off Broadway, that are like
oh,
$38.
I know.
It's crazy.
And I don't understand that because it's like you don't produce off Broadway as a cash cow. Really,
Right,
it
yeah.
really is just about audience. So this is as cheap as we can make it,
That's
and we
awesome.
just but it also shows the value that we just want audience because
Yeah.
that's the real value for me as a performer, me as a writer, and me as a producer, or us as a producing company. My wife is also a co-founder of our company. Is the audience really them? It's nothing, you know. Theater is like you said. It's people listening to a person or people on a stage, and it's that connection. There's nothing like it. It's not TV. It's not film. It's a live thing, and it's not you can't replicate that other than you know it is what it is. And so, having people that are, you know will make it out. We'll be interested to just sit down for 70 minutes and be engaged. We also are doing talk backs on the Saturday and Sunday shows. We have two shows on Saturday and a show, a matinee on Sunday, and there are talk backs after each one.
Nice.
And we're going to have some interesting moderators, or we have most of them set up. We're still reaching out to some others, but it's a very topical show. So I think after you see it, anyone who sees it, they might be interested to stay and partake or at least listen to this.
Excellent. Well, I'm super excited for you, and
Ready?
we'll try to get as many people. Everyone, tell your friends. One
Please.
with the current opens. So the theater that it's going to be at, I believe it's called
It's a 30 36th
36.
Street Studio Theater.
Cool.
36th Street Studio Theater. Yeah, it's in like a theater complex, so it's in the same. It's a small studio space. It seats about 30. Really nice. It's been recently refurbished, and it's elevator access, so no walk-ups. And yeah, we're right in Herald Square, so very in very good proximity to all the trains around there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Danny, for coming on the show.
Thank you, Maddie.
Yeah, once again, super excited for you guys and everybody involved. And
Really appreciate it.
with that said, end scene.